Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. That's our super producer, the one and only Max Williams. Give it up for him, folks. And my name is Ben. I'm a fan of balloons. Noel, it's kind of birthday season for you and me, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Leo season, SZN, as the kids say on the internet. And I am Noel. I don't think I introduced myself in the last episode. So if anyone's confused, it's me, Noel. And yeah, my birthday is August 8th. And I think yours is right around there. Matt Frederick, our compatriot from Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, also has one. Like, I think we're in like a 3 or 4 day span of each other.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if Matt wants me putting his birthday out on the airwaves, but I have the same birth. Well, Hulk Hogan has the same birthday as me, August 11th. That's been a sore point for him in our relationship.
And Hulk Hogan is from my hometown of Augusta, Georgia. So it all comes back around.
It always goes back to Hogan, except for today's episode.
He has nothing to do. He has nothing to do with today's episode.
But it's kind of birthday related because, you know, when you're celebrating in many parts of the world, you're celebrating a birthday or some important event, you get a balloon. And nowadays we see balloons in general as something innocuous, as something fun and interesting, whether we're talking about a little helium balloon that says happy birthday on it, or whether we're talking about a hot air balloon, which I can't wait to get in one once I feel safer about the steering.
Right. Yeah, I think they're still working on that. It's pretty rudimentary still to this day, if I'm not mistaken. Like, a lot of it has to do with ballasts and, you know, getting rid of sandbags and all of that. I don't know. Maybe they've made advancements in hot air balloon technology, but it used to be the absolute height of exploration technology. Not even on purpose, but thank you for pointing that out. Because back in, you know, the early days, the 19th century, the air, the sky was a total mystery in the same way that like the deepest depths of the ocean, you know, were for a long time. And now we would probably make it a little more akin to like the deepest reaches of outer space. As far as they were concerned, it was a weird, bizarro land out there. There was a pretty widespread belief that there were sky monsters, massive, like pterodactyl type birds that could, you know, swoop a man up with his talons and drop him from great heights, like the weird dragons that the Ringwraiths ride in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. That's always a cool flex when you pick somebody up and fly them up high and then drop them to their death.
The Thunderbird, really cool, or the Rock, like the ROC. It goes on and on.
It sure does. But we are talking specifically today about the early days of not astronauts, but aeronauts. These were some super intrepid people that were kind of putting themselves on the line, their lives on the line for the at the time, really, more entertainment purposes. It wasn't even really considered to be a scientific pursuit until a little bit later. I mean, there certainly was that exploratory spirit, but it really became this thing that people would like mob around to check out the latest hot air balloon flight, because chances are someone's probably going to fall to their death.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a common belief that even if they didn't fall to their death, they would die in the atmosphere, because the sky was also thought to contain disease-causing vapors. So folks also validly feared that aeronauts would die of oxygen deprivation. But there were two French brothers, and it's where our story really begins, who bucked those common misconceptions or common beliefs. Joseph Michel Montgolfier and Jacques-Étienne Montgolfier. These are the folks who, on November 21st, 1783, launched the first piloted hot air balloon. And this, a lot of this comes to us from our pals over at Mental Floss, over at the BBC, and an excellent little article in leicestermercury.co.uk.
Also, Smithsonian Mag, there's a fantastic article, The True History of the Aeronauts Who Transformed Our View of the World Above. And that was written by Jennifer Tucker for The Conversation.
So this has already started out on a really weird note, with an opinion from the French monarch, Louis the 16th, because he had a concern. He said, you know, I don't want to be responsible for fatalities when these aeronauts go up into the sky, because they're obviously going to die, right? And he looks around at his court and he's like, they're going to die, right? And everybody's like, yeah, they're going to die.
Probably. And chances are good.
Yeah. And so they had to figure out who could pilot the balloon knowing that they might die, and how to make sure that this wouldn't be a PR disaster when they inevitably passed away. So what did he go with, Noel?
You know, criminals. He just figured, hey, why not? You know, their lives are forfeit anyway. We're talking about ones that were, you know, likely scheduled to be executed. But thankfully, some of the more science-minded individuals in Louis's entourage talked him out of the idea of taking completely, you know, skillless, at least, I'm sure they had some skills, you know, certain set of skills, sure. These criminals.
Murder, but
probably not piloting. Yeah, murder, robbery, petty larceny, all of that stuff. But definitely not piloting hot air balloons, which is a very cutting-edge technology. So it turned out that a scientist by the name of Jean-François Pilliartet de Rosier and an aristocrat named François-Laurent d'Arlans were chosen by the Montgolfier brothers to pilot a balloon. And on November 21st of 1783, they did just that. And they flew for 20 minutes and became the first people to experience sustained flight. So the Montgolfier brothers, what was their deal? They launched a hot air balloon, but the flight didn't last for very long?
Well, they first did a series of animal experiments, similar to what we
see
with space exploration. They launched a hot air balloon with a rooster, a duck, and a sheep. That's right, Ridiculous Historians. There should be a Pixar movie on the way. And they did that just a few months earlier, September 19th, mm-hmm. 1783. And they thought they had a logic to it. They thought sheep are similar enough to people that we'll see how altitude affects landlubber, and ducks and roosters can already fly to one degree or another. And so we'll see how they do when they're not flying on their own power. And that balloon was tethered. So it wasn't flying free and was only up for about, 8 minutes?
Yeah, and I think we talked about this briefly, the idea of the spectacle, because the technology was very rudimentary, and oftentimes the balloons would spontaneously deflate in air. They would drift over the ocean and deflate in the air. They would occasionally catch fire for various reasons, but the duck and the sheep were unharmed. It gives me serious, like, monkeys in space kind of vibes, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep. And the rooster made it through as well.
About the rooster.
You know, maybe the crowd was there chanting, here they come to snuff the rooster. Alice in mm-hmm. Chains' album is based on this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Total facts.
Total facts.
So again, there was this sense of danger.
Yeah.
So there was an absolute kind of almost bread and circuses vibe to these events, because these aeronauts and their passengers often did fall to their death if the balloons were untethered. And people wanted to hang out and see if anything would go horribly, horribly wrong. In fact, the Smithsonian Mag points out that Charles Dickens felt like this was an absolute hideous form of entertainment. He compared them to public executions.
Yeah, kind of like the people who would go to watch a motorsport race purely waiting for an accident to occur. So the British Association for the Advancement of Science in 1862, they say, we're going to fund this. We're going to have a series of flights to study the upper atmosphere, which means these balloons are going to have to fly as high as they possibly can. And
we're talking airplane commercial flight like heights.
The closest they could get to it. I think they managed to get over 20,000 feet pretty quickly. There's a mm-hmm. guy who founded the British Meteorological Society named James Glacier, who volunteered to perform these flights. Between 1862 and 1866, this dude alone made 28 ascents. And, you know, these were funded by the association, not him. He had a pilot. So he's kind of along for the ride to monitor stuff. And this pilot is a guy named Henry Coxwell. At this point, with this, you know, with the age of this technology, he's automatically a world-class expert. Their first flight, they reached the height of 26,177 feet.
That's insane. It gives me vertigo just reading that on a page. Yeah, can you imagine being in that little basket? And they certainly wouldn't have had any like oxygen support, you know, masks or anything at the time. And as we know, you know, the air gets very thin up there and also very, very, very cold. They made another ascent on September 5th in a balloon that was dubbed the Mars. Which again, a lot of this gives me kind of precursor to space travel type vibes.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and they got up to 30,000 feet, but it was an absolute disaster. Glashier went blind for a time while he was up there due to atmospheric pressure, I imagine, and he lost consciousness. And Coxwell, due to like some sort of issue with the rigging, had to climb up into the balloon area and free a tangled valve line. And he wasn't even wearing gloves. And his hands were so cold, they were essentially borderline hypothermic, that he had to rip this valve cord free using his teeth, his bare teeth. The valve lines, you know, again, like I was talking about, it would measure barometric pressure and be able to detect when they had reached a certain height and then would start to ease down their descent. But with a malfunction in that equipment, they would have just continued to rise and rise and rise. Thankfully, he got it free and they did descend. But if he hadn't, they absolutely would have died from freezing to death, hypothermia, or from lack of oxygen. They would have just suffocated in the atmosphere.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Specifically, we believe they reached the height of about 37,000 feet. And just for comparison, Smithsonian and thosemagnificentmen.co.uk make a great comparison here. 37,000 feet is 8,000 feet higher than the summit of Mount Everest. So they have literally gone higher into the atmosphere than any human being ever before throughout the span of history. And they, like you said, Noel, they barely came back to tell the tale. It's interesting because you would think there are a couple of different responses to this if you survive. You might say, okay, that's enough air for me. I have feet and I will keep them on the ground. Or you might think, how much further can I push the envelope? Henry Coxwell was the latter. He decided that he would double down. He made another highly publicized flight, or he prepared for another highly publicized flight in 1864. He was going to launch his balloon, like we said, in front of a crowd. This was publicized. Dickens was not exaggerating when he said this drew lots of crowds. So because he had that close brush with death, he was kind of like a Evel Knievel character, you know, kind of like a stuntman. Like, is this the time he dies?
Yeah, 100%. Probably by some considered to be a hero, a real pioneer, you know, of the air. But by many also probably seemed as being an idiot who was destined for doom any second. And they were hoping to maybe witness that firsthand. And this took place in Leicester in the United Kingdom. And it got a little rowdy. Around 50,000 people showed up to see this launch. And some things went some ways.
So, yes, this reminds me, this feels like a Tim Robinson sketch from I Think You Should Leave Now. So Coxwell's getting his balloon together. And he's working, he's doing his best, you know. He's getting his balloon together, he's getting ready to launch. And then there's some guy in the back who's like, hey, it's a small balloon. Why is that balloon
you
so
sure
small?
About that? You sure about that? That's the reason why? You sure about that? That's the reason why?
Yeah. And so he's like, we're getting ripped off. We're getting ripped off. You sure that's the right balloon? I thought it would be a big balloon. And then everybody else is like, yeah. See, there's a mini balloon. Yeah. And so...
And not to like nag the British people, that's not what we're here to do, but I mean, these were largely working class, you know, soccer hooligan types, you know, who were very much getting riled up and were there to see a show. And they felt, I mean, presumably it was free. So it's sort of, to me, is sort of the equivalent of like why people get so cranky in podcast reviews about like ads or whatever for your free podcast, you know? I don't fully understand. I've never left a review for anything, let alone something that was free. So I'm confused as to how they felt so entitled as to what the show should be or would be. And again, this guy was approaching it very scientifically, and he was approaching it, you know, with the expertise of a seasoned aeronaut, a seasoned balloonist, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so later, Coxwell says that someone mentioned the balloon that he was using was not his largest and newest balloon. And that's how the rumor kind of spread. And that's how people, that's how the conversation got primed. And he said this was libel, and that people were saying that he was somehow swindling them from the spectacle they expected. So the crowd's getting sour. They're gathering closer and closer to the balloon. There's maybe like a couple of cops on duty. They have no chance to control this. And people break into his space, his launch space, and they're like, well, at least take off now. At least take off now. And Coxwell is freaking out because some people had paid to sit in the balloon with him and fly the friendly skies, but there were so many people mobbing it, you know?
And he thought, rightfully, I would think, that those that paid the money would maybe be a little more civilized, but that wasn't true either. They were like clamoring to get in there and actually held up his launch even further. We have some really amazing quotes from Coxwell himself from the BBC article, Victorian Strangeness, The Great Balloon Ride of 1864. It's just a collection of blog posts. It's not credited to any one individual writer. But we have these great quotes, and one of them goes like this. I'm not going to do a voice. I'm just going to go for it. Those who had paid their money and obtained tickets pounced into the basket in such a rude and unceremonious manner that all operations were stopped, and the passengers themselves were preventing their own departure. One person seated in my car was a disgrace to his town, as by his gestures and foul language, he excited the mob and induced the belief that there existed on my part a disinclination to ascend. The pressure of the mob was now so great that my car was damaged, the network broken in several places. I'm assuming he's talking about the patchwork of the lines and all of that. Mm-hmm, exactly. Broken in several places owing to persons hanging on to the lower meshes, and a bottle was thrown into the balloon.
These people were just starting off in a bad mood.
Animals!
Yeah, let's jump forward here. Coxwell says he tries to reason with the crowd and then threatens them with the idea that he'll release the gas in the balloon if they...
I will turn this car around and take you home right now,
right,
children.
If they don't calm down. And that doesn't work. They just start saying, you know, like a pox on you, you fiddlestick or whatever. And so as he says, I forthwith executed my threat. So the balloon collapses. This made people think that Coxwell wasn't punishing them, that they had somehow exposed the big secret that he had a crap balloon. And the Leicester Chronicle reports the moment in a contemporaneous style. They say, to the astonishment of everyone, the canvas, which a few moments before appeared every inch of it to be well filled with gas, began to hang loose and flapped in the wind so much that it was soon apparent that the gas was fast escaping. All doubt on this point was soon dispelled, more especially in regard to those people immediately surrounding it, for the stench became intolerable, and every moment the size of the balloon became less and less, the wind filling its loose folds and causing it to pitch and toss about considerably and threatening every moment to fall upon the heads of those who stood near it. Finally, the whole structure fell into a shapeless mass on the ground. The crowd who stood around immediately seized upon the network and material of the balloon and tore it into 100 shreds. And then they set the basket, the car, they call it, on fire.
Man, people sure did write good back then, didn't they?
I guess so.
You really see it. You can really picture the scene. No, it's really well written. It's true. And again, there were very few security officers on site, so they had to actually call in the heavies, at least, you know, as many as they could get their hands on, and that was two. An Inspector Haynes, and a Sergeant Chapman, who got there to try to do some crowd control. But if I'm not mistaken, Ben, we're talking about 50,000 people here?
Yeah.
How are you gonna do crowd control with like two cops? That doesn't make us very poorly planned.
Well, they thought people would be better behaved, Noel.
I guess so. Well, anyway, they very quickly realized they couldn't control this throng, so they just decided, we got to get Coxwell the hell out of here, because they're going to tear him limb from limb like they tore his poor balloon basket.
Yeah, yep. And this, they finally, the Sergeant Chapman leads Coxwell away while the crowd is screaming for his blood and literally tearing his clothes off of him. And they're yelling stuff like, rip him up, finish him, just like in Mortal Kombat, which is also—
bonk him on the head, things like that.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. And so they're on the run. Coxwell hides out in the town clerk's house, which is nearby. And while, just to give you a sense of how chaotic this is, folks, some of those people who had ripped parts of Coxwell's clothing off immediately turn around and start selling pieces of that and pieces of the torn balloon as souvenirs of this this disastrous riot. It's like, I don't know about people selling riot memorabilia mid-riot. I think that takes some hustle, for real.
Yeah, it's a special kind of awful. And again, from that amazing BBC collection of, you know, reports from this event, there is a quote from a letter writer who wrote into the Chronicle, kind of describing the scene and, you know, complaining about almost being trampled to death. I never witnessed such barbarous ignorance, baseness, and injustice in my life. I feared Mr. Coxwell would be killed. I was knocked down thrice myself simply for endeavoring to defend him. So this points out about something I think we should mention. Obviously, of that 50,000, surely there was a decent contingent of people who are just fans of the guy,
sure,
and did not distrust him. It was obviously like a certain element that was getting people all riled up, and maybe there was alcohol involved. I don't know, but it sure sounds like it, because I don't understand what you're right. It is such an absurdist thing, like from one of those Tim Robinson sketches, like the balloon's too small.
Exactly.
Kill him. You know, yeah. I mean, it's like absurd.
And then
probably a smaller balloon is what you want. I bet like it's more nimble, right? A smaller balloon is probably what you want.
Well, they're you sure about that? You sure about that? But
I am not.
They're ripping the thing that's so weird to me, man, is they're demanding the balloon be launched, and then they start attacking the balloon. They tried to launch. It's very weird. It's very strange. But we know that the town of Leicester got a really bad name in the press for this. The London Review of Politics, Society, Literature, Art, and Science characterized them as a horde of savages as fierce and untamed as South Sea Islanders. This was the racism common at the time.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, and then they also said, it's humiliating to think that after all the civilizing influences that have been exerted upon them, so much of the savage should still linger in the blood of our working classes. So you can kind of see that who this review is aiming to communicate with. So classism goes in their own way. They're being just as trashy, I would argue, as the mob in Leicester. But over in Leicester Town, if you walk over there afterwards, you would hear a lot of the locals, some of whom were doubtlessly tearing out this balloon earlier. You'll hear them say, "No, that was all from out of towners, or maybe those jerks from what was it, Nottingham?" Which I love that idea. They're like, anything bad that happens in this town, it's those monsters from Nottingham, those fiddlesticks.
The town brass, like you said, that was blaming the folks from Nottingham, referred to them as excursionists. And we're going to get into some nicknames now. It's kind of fun. People from Leicester, by the way, are known as Leicestrians. That's not a term of abuse. But one that was hurled at them by, you know, the greater public was Chizzits. Don't have an etymology behind that. Not quite sure what that's referring to. But in 1864, Punch magazine, which is a fantastic satirical magazine that ran for a very long time, if it's not still running, if I'm not mistaken, but they called them Balloonatics.
Love it.
Which sounds like a punk band or like a kind of a synth wave, kind of tongue-in-cheek synth wave band. Really cool. The Balloonatics.
I did find one speculative guess at the etymology of Chizzits. Apparently it refers to the phrase, how much is it, as one word.
As in they're cheap, as in they're low class. Because if you're like upper class, you don't ever ask how much something is. You know that you can either afford it or you can't.
If you have to ask, you're maybe in the wrong shop. Yeah. So this is ludicrous, but it is instructive. And we're happy to report that over time, technology improved in the world of ballooning and aeronautics. And as it improved, hot air balloon pilots or aeronauts became more skilled because they had more of an opportunity to gain experience. And then soon enough, you could take passengers with you on longer excursions as long as they would pay for the trip. We believe at the time that around the time Glacier himself was ascending, the guy who went so many times during that short year period.
Mm-hmm. He was that early balloon evangelist, right?
Yeah, yeah, the Parmentier of the balloons there. At that time, it would cost you about 600 pounds, which we estimate is somewhere north of $90,000 today, to just to build a balloon. So if you wanted to ride one, you would have to pay 50 pounds to hire a pilot and just to rent the balloon and to pay for the gas for a single trip. So this was expensive. This was not yet something the middle or working class could do. And people loved it. People love exclusive stuff, right? So they would just, it's kind of like reporting the taste of pineapple during the pineapple craze. They're like, this is amazing. I don't know how to describe it. I guess you've just got to go. You know, just mm-hmm. go for yourself.
You just had to have been there.
Exactly.
You just had to have been there and, you know, been rich. But thankfully, I mean, yeah, like you said, this really did turn much more towards scientific pursuits. We start to see more scientific reports about the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere. In 1873, we have one scientist describing it as a, quote, splendid world of colors which brightens the surface of our planet with a lovely azure tint and changing harmonies of various hues that lighten up the world. This is also from that Smithsonian Mag article about the balloons and the aeronauts that transformed our view of the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this does help the human species advance understanding of various meteorological phenomena. Scientists get new insight into meteors. They understand more about the relationship between altitude and temperature, aka it gets really freaking cold if you go up too far. They understood how hail and snow and rain formed. They were able to get up into the clouds literally, which people had wanted to do for millennia. And
totally.
And today you can ride a hot air balloon.
And you have to think of how transformative this would have been. You know, you always hear about astronauts reporting. I mean, maybe not, Jeff Bezos is officially not an astronaut, but, right. You know, most of his commentary for his brief space flight were about, like, how he wants to build factories on the moon or whatever. But in general, astronauts typically say things like, when you see that view of the planet, you know, disconnected from, you know, being on the ground, and you see it, this disembodied kind mm-hmm. of floating orb, it really gives you this perspective on your place in the universe and all that. And that would have been true too of people viewing the Earth, the surface of the Earth from the air. I know every time I take a flight, I still haven't gotten jaded to like looking out the window and seeing, like, you know, flying over, say, Utah, for example, sure. seeing all the salt, you know, deposits, and just, it looks like you're literally seeing the surface of an alien planet. I still very much am taken by that. And so for this to be very, very new, it would have been really, really exciting.
Yeah, that's a good point, Noel, because I see what you're saying. What people must have been experiencing is a version of what's known as the overview effect. That's what astronauts mm-hmm. are experiencing. And I'm with you. I like a good window seat anytime I can get it. It's just amazing, especially you're flying over like the Grand Canyon or something. It never loses its luster. Today, if you are someone who wants to ride a hot air balloon, you might be surprised by how close some hot air balloon festivals are to a town near you. And Noel, Max, here in Georgia at Callaway Gardens, which isn't too far away, there's a hot air balloon festival this September, if you guys want to go.
Awesome. I think we can probably expense that. Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. We'll tell the suits it's for research. Max, are you down? You want to go in a hot air balloon with us?
Definitely not.
Oh, I'm not going up in the balloon. I'll watch them from the ground. But y'all go with God. I wish you the best. Bon voyage.
Absolutely, absolutely not. I'm afraid of heights. I will not get in a hot air balloon.
You guys are going to make me go solo? Okay, I'll wear like a GoPro or something and relay the footage down to you. Will that work?
I wish you the best, Ben.
Thanks,
Godspeed. I wish I could do it with you, Ben, but you would not enjoy it if I went with you.
I would be like a cat, like clawing, you know, when you see a dog come in and the cat's just like back arched and like claws digging into the, I would be like that, but like on the basket, just like flattened like a cartoon character, mm-hmm. like Bugs Bunny in that one with the gremlin where he's on the plane. Mm-hmm. And I think at one point he gets pushed outside the plane. And you see his like heart pumping in his chest and he's literally like clutching the side of the plane. That would be me. I'm fine with flights. I have no problem with that. But an open bucket in the sky. I barely like riding like ski lifts and things like that. So yeah, I'm sorry. I hate to have to pass, but
no worries at all. I got your back, guys. Here's what we'll do. We're still gonna tell the network that all three of us are going up. And then we're gonna use that other 2/3 as just, you know, walking around pocket money for our adventure. Got a yes sir from Max on that one.
Maybe we could bring a chicken and a goat and a rooster or something like that.
You know, just so.
Can we expense that as well?
Oh, you know we can.
Yeah, we got a rooster guy. Don't we know? Didn't we get a rooster guy?
Steve.
Oh, Steve. That's right. Steve the rooster guy. Sheep guy's different guy. But I've always wanted to go in a hot air balloon, and we'd be glad to relay footage of you. Let me ask you this. I know we're at the end of our show here, but where are we at as a group on blimps, dirigibles, airships? Does it matter?
I'd be cool with that because it's enclosed.
Okay.
You know, right. And there's probably like craft services and stuff, you know, like I'd be good with that. There's probably like a, you know, sleeper car type situation, but I think blimps have largely outlived their usefulness. I think we did a story about blimps, how they used to be used for low altitude surveillance, but I think there are probably better ways of doing that, AKA drones. Obviously the Goodyear blimp will always be a thing, but that's really more just like, you know, a visual during sporting events. But I think it would be awesome to go up in the Goodyear blimp. I would love that. I love the vision of the future that you see sometimes in these stories, mm-hmm. where it's like everything's, you know, everyone's going to be flying by blimp and they're all tethered to buildings and you have to shimmy down some sort of line to get to the, you know, landing pad. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Interesting stuff. It's very Sky Captain in the world of tomorrow.
Yeah, or like in Fringe. Oh, wait, spoilers. Okay, well, dirigibles are in that show. It's a good show. Check it out. With this, we have to say we can't wait to hear from anybody who is a balloonist or an aeronaut who has explored the friendly skies in this way. It sounds like my compatriots Noel and Max are maybe not on board to fly with you, but would probably welcome hearing the story. I wish everyone could see just how Max. I am sorry. I didn't know that. Like I didn't know. I can see how hard you're noping going up there. This reminds me a little bit, Noel. Max's reaction reminds me a little bit of when we've talked about you being in the open ocean, which is also not your vibe, I believe.
I mean, I'm fine if I'm close to, you know, shore. I'll swim in the ocean if I'm close to the beach, but I do have some pretty big fears of deep, deep, deep water ocean because of the massive, you know, Leviathan-type beasts that dwell just beneath the placid surface.
Similar to the way people originally felt about the sky. What's down
100%.
There? What's up there? We brought it back. We did it. We brought it back.
We did. On a Friday, no less. Huge thanks to Max, you super producer, and Casey Pegram, super producer as well. Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
Yes, and big thanks, of course, to the balloonist of our hearts. I don't know, we'll work on it. But we're talking about Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. Quister. Big thanks to that guy, Christopher Asiotis. Big thanks to everyone, honestly, everyone who braved those mysterious skies, because inspiration aside, they provided some priceless insights to our understanding of science. I can't believe no balloons, huh? Okay. Well, I'm going to cancel plans. I had this on the calendar.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.